from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Cory Doctorow's young adult novel Little Brother plunges readers into a dystopic version of San Francisco, where the Bay Bridge is attacked by terrorists and the Department of Homeland Security reigns supreme. Doctorow's novel draws as much from scientific fiction classics 1984 and Fahrenheit 451 as it does on the current debates on government surveillance and information leaks. And we'll talk with him next about his writing and his work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and to city librarian Luis Herrera about why the book was selected as the San Francisco Public Library's One City, One Book selection of 2013. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. And in this hour of Forum, we're going to be joined by author Cory Doctorow, whose young adult thriller Little Brother has been chosen by the San Francisco Public Library as its One City, One Book selection this year. It's a real page-turner. Couldn't put it down. We'll find out what it's all about in a moment. But first, we want to talk with city librarian Luis Herrera, who joins us to talk about the program, One City, One Book. And Luis Herrera, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be on.
I guess the initial question is an obvious one. How do you make these selections? I told Cory Booker, before we went on the air, that I thought, this guy's from Canada and he lives in London. why do they select? But the book is so San Francisco-based. Do they have to be San Francisco-based?
We like to get a theme that really resonates with San Franciscans. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be a local author. Most of them have been, but there's got to be some tie-in to either themes or, in this particular case, it's all about San Francisco.
It certainly is. In fact, those who love local details, even got some stuff here on Potrero Hill where we're located, because that's close by where Cory Doctorow used to live when he lived in San Francisco, and he knows the city quite intimately. Was this selection, did it create any controversy? Because it's a kind of a Ferris Bueller character. I mean, he's a truant, and in fact, the novel starts with him sort of taking the day off from school. He's a rebel. Even got a sex scene in there, and you got teachers, characterized as living like pigs in terms of how they use a microwave and all.
Well, let me briefly just tell you about the selection process. There's a wonderful group of folks, community members, folks that represent independent booksellers, or some of our librarians, people that really sort of know the landscape. And then they narrow it down after they have wonderful discussions, read the three or four final titles, and then make the selection. But we want books that are reflective of universal issues that face San Franciscans and the Bay Area. Certainly mirrors the diversity of the city. So, yeah, the topics are provocative, and we want that because we want people to have dialogue, to really be engaged through that common thread of literature. So this is a perfect topic because it addresses, as you'll hear later with Cory, civil liberties, privacy issues, technology. And then the other piece that's so important is that we wanted to reach a younger demographic. So what better book than a young adult book? And it really sort of crosses both the adult genre, but also that YA group. And it resonates. It resonates with the readers, and we're having a lot of fun with it.
Well, the main character, Marcus Yellow, is a teen hacker, and the voice of the kid is really quite credible. I can see kids just really enjoying this book, but maybe I'm a kid at heart, but I really enjoyed it too. Young adult genre doesn't necessarily limit to young adults.
Absolutely. I was telling Cory that actually I felt like he was channeling a 17-year-old into myself, so it's a lot of fun.
And the public school students all read this book, yeah?
Yes, and the exciting thing about the project is that we've got a variety of programs because we really want to go out into the community. So Corey's actually going to be visiting high schools and talking to young students. We also have a whole slew of programs that not only engage the adult community, but also everything from robotics to conversations about online privacy, civil liberties on digital as a digital citizen. So these are important topics, and we really want to make sure that we focus on the digital community.
I've been involved in One City, One Book in, well, one county in Marin, mm-hmm. but also in San Mateo. Did an event there, in fact, with Dave Eggers a few years ago. But what's the purpose behind this in San Francisco, and how long have you been extant?
This is our ninth year, Michael, and every year gets bigger and better. And I have to say that it probably engages upwards to 10,000 individuals, either through attending programs or reading the book. It's important because we want that not only promoting reading, but we have a very active literary community, and it's just an opportunity to spark conversation and to have those discussions and to have those communities of readers with a given topic and a given book.
Well, good luck with it, and thank you so much for joining us. That's Luis Herrera, who is city librarian for the San Francisco Public Library. And Cory Doctorow joins us in studio this hour to discuss his book. It's a dystopian young adult thriller called Little Brother, and as we've said, it's set in San Francisco. It's all about technology and freedom of speech and Big Brother in the form of the Department of Homeland Security, and it was selected as this year's San Francisco One City, One Book selection. Its author was named as one of the web's 25 influencers by Forbes magazine and a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. He's also co-editor of Boing Boing. I remember Gerald Mick Boing Boing, but that's a tech... actually read by a lot of the really uber techies. He's also a columnist for The Guardian, for Locust, for Publishers Weekly, and other novels include Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, Homeland, Makers, and Private Cinema. Joins us in studio. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
Were you a listener when you lived up there?
I was indeed. Yeah, I grew up listening to public radio in Canada and used to shout at my dad whenever he'd put it on because he'd walk around the house in the morning turning it on every radio. And then when I moved out, I found myself unpacking boxes and there was something missing and I turned on public radio and basically haven't turned it off since.
Well, and you are no relation to Edgar L. Doctorow. We want to get that. Well, you may be, but not that you know. But you also were director of Electronic Frontier Foundation, a copyright activist. You have and a librarian.
Well, no, I worked in libraries. That's right. And I was the European director of EFF. I was by no means the director of EFF. That was someone who was my boss's boss, but I was the European director.
European director. And have been a novelist. And this is – it's a page-turner. It's a revenge novel. It's a thriller. It's also a polemic, though.
Mm-hmm.
And you make no bones about that.
No, not at all. I don't think there's anything wrong with wearing your politics on your sleeve when you're writing. I think there's nothing in there that I don't stand behind, and I hope I make the case for it. Obviously, you know, there is no one book that I think anyone should read to understand any important issue, but I think that if you're going to read lots of books, that they should have strong points of view.
Well, you do have a strong point of view, and it's a book about terrorism here in San Francisco, blowing up the Bay Bridge. I'm not giving away too much of the plot.
Yeah, that's in chapter one. Driving over the Bay Bridge to go to some high schools yesterday in the East Bay.
A little foreboding.
There's always a bit when I get past Treasure Island where I think, my goodness, it would certainly suck if the Bay Bridge were to blow up right now. It was very nice to see the new span, actually. Beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And what happens, I mean, like, I just want to give a little tease here, is Marcus Winston, by name in terms of his handle, although if you're a real techie, he wouldn't call him Winston, right? He gets caught up cutting school. He's in the Tenderloin, in fact, and the Bay Bridge explodes, his worst terrorist act in America's history, including 9/11, and he gets picked up by Homeland Security, and they put a bag over his head, and we get into that whole sense of, and it's a main theme in the book, of what is done in the name of security versus freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you take a stand.
Yeah. So I actually, the stand that I take is that security and freedom are the same thing, and that
they're not polarized with each other.
Yeah,
or mutually exclusive.
Yeah. I mean, we hear this sometimes. We hear privacy and security put on opposite ends of a teeter-totter. But the thing that you want to be secure for, the reason we want security is to have the integrity of our lives, to have our freedom. It's no security at all to be in jail. And so I really wanted in the book to show that when you take away freedom in the name of security, you actually undermine security too. I also tried to get into some of the statistics of risk, because I think a misapprehension of the statistics of risk is really at the core of some of our biggest social problems, and to really show that if you don't appreciate the actual likelihood of risk, and if you're willing to take away freedom in the name of some sort of security theater exercise that is meant to marginally reduce risk but really has no effect at the margin, then you've really done the worst of all possible worlds. You've taken away freedom and not created any new security.
But I'm the kind of reader, I found myself thinking, would Homeland Security, even in the wake of something this devastating, go to those degrees, you know, take a kid and torture him and incarcerate him? I found myself when the kids got loose, and they do get loose, but there's lots more that happens, obviously, in the wake of that. I thought, wouldn't he want to go to his parents right away? I mean, he's more with his gang. I don't know what to call him. It's the cadre.
Sure. You know, I think that in terms of what is capable of being done in the name of fighting the war on terror, we're only beginning to plumb the depths of it. So much of it has been conducted behind closed doors that we don't really get to find out about it. But we know that extraordinary rendition was practiced. We know that Americans have been murdered off the field of battle with no warrant, no judicial oversight, by remote control. As a foreigner, you know, I know that the American government has taken aim at foreigners in lots of ways, large and small. Obviously, Glenn Greenwald's boyfriend was detained in London as part of the global war on terror and held for many hours and questioned very intensively. My friend Jacob Applebaum, who's an American activist who works on WikiLeaks, can't come back to America. He's effectively living in exile because every time he crosses in, he gets a more thoroughgoing treatment from the Customs and Border Patrol and now feels like he can't safely re-enter America. So I don't think it's a terrible stretch to say that in the name of the war on terror, we'll torture innocents, including children, given that...
Including our own children.
Well, I'm not all that bothered about the distinction between Americans and other people. As a foreigner, I think that the important step is willingness to torture children. And once you've crossed that Rubicon, the willingness to torture a child who happens to carry a certain passport or another passport is really a very small extra step to take. I think that there is no defense for torture, and there's especially no defense for torturing children. And given that we know it's happened, I don't find it that much of a stretch to think that an American child might someday be tortured in the name of preventing a terrorist attack or getting to the bottom of one.
Corey, Dr. O'Hare with us in studio, author of Little Brother and co-editor of the website Boing Boing and former European director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And he'll appear in conversation with Nick O'Sell at the San Francisco Main Library, 6 o'clock this evening. There's so much technology in here. I mean, this all takes place in sort of the near future. And you could almost read this book just to get a lesson. In fact, at one point, the narrator says to us, here's the cliff notes on this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is certainly understandable, and some of it, frankly, is not to those who are not technologically as advanced as you are. Did you want to also provide kind of a – I mean, it's a kind of celebration of technology. Let's just
sure.
get that out there. It really is. I mean, at one point, you know, he talks about how important technology should be to citizens and to himself and all sorts, but not without making it seem too didactic. It's there. This is what the kid does. It's his life. But you wanted it to be a learning tool also to readers?
I did. You know, I feel like technology, when properly used, can be used to enhance freedom in lots of ways, small and large. It allows us to form groups so easily that we're able to work together on political causes that matter to us, on social issues that matter to us, and has been an enormous boon. But technology used to take away liberty can be done in such a totalizing way that it makes Orwell look like a kind of naive optimist. And so what I wanted to convey was some of the ways that technology can be used to take liberty and to improve liberty and to safeguard it. When I was growing up, you know, forbidden knowledge came in the form of books like Steal This Book, where it was full of facts that you know, were sort of hard to come by.
You don't even look that old. You're talking about Abby Hoffman.
Yeah. But these days, you know, any piece of forbidden knowledge you want to find is there at the end of a search query. The tricky thing isn't finding it. It's knowing what to search for. And so I thought that by writing up scenarios in which people use real technology to take control of their lives and to make themselves more free, that it would give people a starting point, a place to start at their own search engine and figure out how to make their computers more secure and how to make their communications more secure and how to safeguard the integrity of their personal lives using technology.
But at the same time, the warning is implicit. I mean, this kid goes to school and they're measuring the gates, the walks of school. I mean, all this is a technology that invades privacy and that you see, I mean, your authorial hand obviously is in here saying this is all very perilous to us, to our personal liberties. And at one point, though, passage says, the best part of all this is how it made me feel, technology, in control. My technology was working for me, serving me, protecting me. It wasn't spying on me. That's why I love technology. If you used it right, it could give you power and privacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are in the middle of a kind of inchoate debate over whether or not the default posture of the tools in our lives should be yes, master, or I can't let you do that, Dave. And, you know, because everything in our world today involves computers, and soon everything in our world will require computers, everyone who's got a problem to solve, whether that's copyright infringement or the war on terror or anything in between, arrives at the same solution, which is, can't you just make me a computer that can run all the programs except for the one I don't like? And we don't know how to make a computer that can run every program except for the ones that Apple hasn't blessed, or the ones that infringe copyright, or the ones that allow terrorists to send messages to each other. And our closest approximation is a computer that has some kind of hidden program running on it, watching what you do, that tries to interdict you when you do something that's not supposed to be done. And as soon as you start designing computers that can hide things from the people who use them, you sort of sow the seeds of a future in which computers are controlling people, because anyone who manages to hijack that facility, anyone who uses the mote in the computer's eye where the "I can't let you do that, Dave" program lives, can do terrible things to people. You know, I think the story of the century was last month when Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald revealed that the NSA and the British GCHQ have been spending $250 million a year to undermine and sabotage computer security. That's a big deal, because that's the security of the aviation system and the banking system, the education system. You know, I think it's really important that those things be made as secure as possible. And secure as possible includes not having back doors.
Well, you also, at one point, have your protagonist say, learn how to write code. If you want to be in charge of your machines, learn to write code. Again, the sense of making us have more agency, the sense of making us have more agency to be better citizens. I mean, this is a kid who becomes heroic, really, in many respects. I mean, in his belief in the Constitution and all that this republic presumably should stand for, and goes up against Homeland Security. Now, It's a wonderful kind of Quixote journey, you know, to have a kid go up against something like Homeland Security. And yet, I suppose if the technical tools are there, I mean, there are people who are jamming these kinds of operations every day.
Well, I think that what networks do and computers do at their best is they lower the cost of coordination, of working together. And solving coordination problems, collective action problems, is what we've done since, you know, our neocortex evolved, since we became the kind of primates that shared the workload. And, you know, you watch the you watch for tigers and I'll watch the kids and that one's going to go off and gather the food. And by definition, the establishment is the group of people who figured out how to coordinate themselves, and everyone else is a group of people who haven't. When you give everyone cheaper coordination, you make a change in kind, in degree for the establishment, but you make a change in kind for the resistance. You know, when I was a young activist in the 1980s, 98% of my time was spent stuffing envelopes and writing addresses on them, and 2% was spent figuring out what to put in the envelopes. And now you get the envelopes for free, right? And that's a huge difference. Now, the state has always figured out how to stuff envelopes and put addresses on them. That's not a big deal to get the envelopes for free. But for everyone else, for whom that was the 98% occupation of your life, the tax that you paid on your collective action, to get that for free frees up an enormous surplus of time and attention and energy to work on more substantial issues and not have to muck around with the logistics. And so, yeah, I think one of the things technology can do is radically uproot the way that we conduct ourselves and, you know, in the most wonderful way, you know, banish things like conference calls and meetings and memos and org charts, or at least reserve them for things that are genuinely complex and create a whole realm of things that we can do together with very little organizational infrastructure, with very little formal constitution, that are nevertheless ambitious and wonderful things on the scale of an encyclopedia or an operating system that, you know, we used to think would require an army well-organized and tightly coordinated people, and now we do with the kind of organization we used to bring to a bake sale. That's amazing. That's a massive change
in
human history.
In many, many ways, and yeah. Certainly makes life more efficient, potentially, and all that. No question about it. We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Cory Doctorow. He's the author of Little Brother and is here, actually, because his book was chosen as one book, one San Francisco library selection that they do every year, San Francisco Public Library's One City, One Book selection for the year 2013. I like the fact that you even in the novel, bring in Alan Turing, who turns out to be kind of a heroic figure to our young hero, Marcus. And, you know, there's a sense of you're wanting people, readers, to know who Alan Turing is.
Mm-hmm.
The kid knows who he is. The kid's a computer, I guess an uber geek, really, so he would know who he is, but also wanting to know about, you know, his tragedy and his personal life as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Turing is one of those towering figures, really. I mean, his insights continue to resonate.
Probably nobody more responsible for the computer, really.
Really? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, on the one hand, Churchill said that he and his colleagues lopped years off the war and saved millions of lives by breaking the German and Japanese codes. But on the other hand, he and von Neumann and certain other people created not only the first practical computers, but the theoretical basis for computing that we still operate on today. You know, we talk about a computer being fully functional when it is Turing complete, because Turing described this theoretical architecture for a computer that could execute all programs that could be expressed in symbolic language. And a computer isn't done unless it's Turing complete. And one of the amazing things that happens at technical conferences is there's always some presentation of someone going, I figured out a way that something we never thought of, something we thought of as a toy, can be made Turing complete. That Magic the Gathering card game that people play, that kind of competitive collectible card game, there is a way to order those cards such that they are Turing complete. I mean, very slow. You wouldn't want to do anything computationally intensive with them. But nevertheless, you can, given enough time and enough Magic the Gathering cards, run any program you can run on a you know, high-powered multi-processor CPU. Now, it may take a lot of time and a lot of Magic the Gathering cards, like all the time remaining between now and the heat death of the universe and enough cards to stretch to the moon and back, but it's still amazing, right? There appears to be some kind of latent Turing completeness lurking in the universe's own fabric. It's fantastic.
You're really enthusiastic about this.
I really am.
Yeah. People are pretty enthusiastic about your book, too, aren't they? It's getting real good reception.
People have been very kind about this book and the sequel that came out last year, Homeland, which came out in February and was on the New York Times list for 4 weeks.
People thought it might have been the TV series?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, I actually have a whole series of short stories that deliberately have the same titles as famous novels. But in that case, it was just a coincidence.
Just a few little touches I wanted to bring to listeners in this novel. We're talking about Little Brother. This kid is pretty sharp, and the protagonist, Marcus, he says, you can always spot the tourists in San Francisco. They're the ones who think California equals warm and spend their San Francisco holidays freezing in shorts and T-shirts. And then he says, lady, the ACLU is suing, later on in the novel, 300 cops on the SFPD, and you're going to have to get in line. I mean, you bring in a lot of the feel of San Francisco.
Yeah.
In the ACLU, Goat Hill Pizza, tourists, sure. And how they're viewed by kids, and really get us through the city.
Well, it's a great city. It's a great city for a story about radicals, because it's got such a radical history, and you see them popping up in the most unlikely places. One of my favorite places to talk at when I go to San Francisco is Berkeley High.
And hold that thought, because we want to get people involved in this
conversation
and invite them to join us with Cory Doctorow. You can do that right now at our toll-free number. We invite you to join the conversation. It's 866-733-6786. Anything you'd like to contribute to our conversation, please feel free to join us at our toll-free number, which again is 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Cory Doctorow. We spoke earlier with Luis Herrera, city librarian of San Francisco Public Library, and Cory Doctorow's book was chosen as the San Francisco Public Library's One City, One Book selection for 2013. If you want just a really good techno thriller, or want to find out how to catch a spy cam, or crypto cliff notes, they're all all and more in the book here. You were finishing a thought before we went to the break. I want to bring our callers in, but please.
Sure. I was just saying what a great city San Francisco is to tell a story about radicals and how they pop up everywhere. When I come to San Francisco, I often give talks at the Berkeley High Public Library, or the Berkeley High Library, and the librarian there is this amazing woman whose dad was an SFPD cop detective, and she always tells this great story about how one day the DHS dropped in on a fishing expedition where they said, "We want all of your yearbooks back to the 40s. God knows why. I mean, some, you know, it's the greater haystack theory of needle finding, right? If you just throw enough useless information and eventually you'll find some correlation. But she said, "Well, that's fine. Where's your warrant?" And they said, "You know, lady, don't you want to help us enforce the law?" And she said, "My dad was an SFPD detective. I know how you enforce the law. You get a warrant. Now go get a warrant." They never came back. And you meet those people all over the place in San Francisco. So it is a great place to write a story like that.
Also, there's something, a lot that I learned from your book. I mean, in fact, some of the technology is really sort of futuristic, isn't it? Or is it all pretty much a part of us? I thought of Gary Steingart's novel. I don't know if you know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's all technology that could exist.
Yeah.
It's all made out of parts that we have today. Not all of it does exist, but there's no reason why it couldn't.
Could you take an Xbox and do all these marvelous things with it?
So, yeah. I mean, when the first Xboxes came out, this great technologist named Bunny Huang, who was a grad student at MIT, figured out how to break them so that he could install his own operating system on them, GNU Linux on them, and run any program he wanted. And we at Electronic Frontier Foundation represented him because he was worried he was going to get sued by Microsoft. And so Bunny actually writes one of the afterwards for the book explaining how he came to do it. You know, there's this funny thing. Since 1998, since Congress passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's illegal to remove software that is supposed to protect copyright or prevent illegal copying, even if you're doing something legal. And in many cases where you have a console or another device like it, like an iPhone or whatever, that is locked down so you can't install your own software, the manufacturers argue that if you modify your own computer so it can run your own programs, that you break the law because you weaken the anti-copying technology in it. And so, you know, this is a very weird thing. It's like saying, you know, once you've got a bookcase, if you put a book from HarperCollins on it, HarperCollins gets to tell you what to do with the bookcase from then on. It's a very strange state of affairs to be in, and it's only getting weirder as computers enter more and more realms in our life. But, you know, I think Bunny's essay in the book and his own book, which is called Hacking the Xbox, are real, you know, calls to action to seize the means of information, you know, jailbreak every device and make it your own.
I got to ask you about one thing before we go to our callers here. Esprit d'escalier.
Escalier, yeah.
I mean, it's a French term, and I never encountered it before. Probably some of my learned listeners know it, or Gallic lovers and so forth. But it's a great concept. Kid's going through some tough stuff with the Homeland Security, and he thinks of what he could have said in rebuttal, or what he should have said. How many people go through that? I mean,
Yeah, and if you're, you know, a career arguer, you often get esprit d'escalier. You often walk away and go, "You know what I really should have said?" And I think you get a lot of that on the internet. You know, that famous XKCD comic, I can't go to bed now. Someone is wrong on the internet.
Go to your callers here. First, Magnus writes, "Is Doctorow's vision of a police state on steroids with government-sponsored terrorism deployed to justify abolishing our rights and freedoms and the rule of law even possible?" In a word, yes. In fact, we are nearly there.
Well, I think that lots of people have made the point that even if you trust and like the government that we have, that when you create the system, the systems of control, they are very difficult to dismantle. It doesn't really matter how much you trust this government. It's all the governments that will follow. Back when, you know, I live in the United Kingdom, and back when the old Labour government was contemplating national biometric ID cards with a single unitary identity linking all of your actions through society, one of the things that we said is you are putting ammunition in a gun that you're going to hand on to every parliament that's going to sit from now on. It doesn't matter how trustworthy you think you are. It's how trustworthy will your successors be when the opposition gets into power.
The real fire under you, though, for this book had a lot to do with the Patriot Act, didn't it?
It really did. I mean, I think, you know, there are people who have weird conspiracy theories about 9/11 and who caused it and whatever. And I think you don't need a conspiracy theory to feel like the response to 9/11 was depraved in its indifference to liberty. I think the fact that a multi-hundred-page act was introduced days after 9/11 tells you that there are people who, when they contemplated a disaster striking the country that they were charged with protecting, that what they said is, you know, we should really just have something in a drawer that lets us take away people's liberties in that moment of dislocation following a disaster. Because when that happens, it would be great. It would be very convenient for us to figure out how to line the pockets of our, you know, military contractor friends. That is far more despicable than anything that the, you know, conspiracy theorist has accused the administration at the time of 9/11 of. The idea that you prepare for disaster by figuring out how to line your pockets, you know, that's to my mind much worse than actually planning a disaster.
That's very much in the American way, though, and perhaps the Western ways. Let's go to our callers. First caller is Charles. Good morning.
Good morning. First, I'm thinking that that really the buck stops at Obama with the current proliferation of the NSA spying. It really comes back to Obama. But my question is this. Is there a future for encryption? Is it possible that maybe some open source code or something like that in the future, individuals will be able to encrypt their, you know, do their own encryption somehow? Could that technology proliferate, or do you think that the government is going to clamp down and preclude such a thing?
Actually, Corey, before you go into a response, I'm looking at a question on NSA and encryption, and this is from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, who issued a statement saying, and I'm quoting, "Throughout history, nations have used encryption to protect their secrets, and today terrorists, cyber criminals, human traffickers, and others also use code to hide their activities. Our intelligence community would not be doing its job if we did not try to counter that."
Yeah, so I think that there is an amazing fact about the universe, which is that it wants us to have secrets. It is far easier to scramble a message than it is to de-scramble it. When I say far easier, I mean trillions of times, heptillions of times easier to scramble a message than it is to brute force a de-scrambling of it. So it's not just the case that in the future we may be able to scramble things such that people who aren't invited into our conversation can't read over our shoulder. That's the fact today. The reason that the NSA was engaged in sabotaging computer security is because they can't break encryption. You know, we all use the same good crypto to scramble our messages. And
who's
once
that woman Glenn Greenwald safe. Works with all the time now? You mentioned Glenn Greenwald.
The woman in Germany. Gosh, I'm blanking on her name.
I mean, she's also been hassled a lot. Yeah. But boy, does she understand encryption.
Yes, sure. I mean, Laura Poitras. I'm mangling
her name. That's close to the mark. Yeah.
But you know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, part of its origin is that in the early 90s, the NSA classed encryption as a munition and limited its civilian use. And there was a University of Berkeley mathematician named Daniel Bernstein who was publishing code that allowed people to securely encrypt their messages in such a way that they couldn't be decrypted by anyone except for their intended parties. And EFF successfully defended his right to publish that on the First Amendment grounds, on the grounds that code is a form of expressive speech, and the government didn't have the right to limit your ability to speak expressively, and that was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Every secure transaction you've ever had on the internet has been thanks to that decision. That's why we have good, strong crypto. To distinguish between trying to break crypto and trying to sabotage internet security, which is, you know, the line that the head of the NSA is walking there, I think is very important, because it's one thing to try and figure out how to descramble your enemy's messages. It's another thing entirely to weaken the fabric of the security that protects everything from the ignition systems in our car to the aviation and air traffic control systems to the authentication systems for our implanted defibrillators to our logins for our banks to our phones and every other part of the information technology that makes up our world. To deliberately undermine the security of that and assume that the only people who ever take advantage of the deliberately undermined security there will be the good guys is absolutely unrealistic and completely disproportionate. That is an actual existential threat to the safety of all of us.
I remember Eric Schmidt being on this program and saying, he kind of conceded, can find out anything we want. We can know anything we want, really, within reason, not only about you, me, the government. Google has that power.
I think we can make a distinction between people who may unwisely let Google know about themselves and a coercive, secret, corrupt program that spends hundreds of millions of taxpayers' dollars to illegally confiscate freedoms that they've never willingly given up. I think people give Google too much information, but that's a problem of people making bad decisions. But there's a huge difference between people making bad decisions and the government seizing information that it has no legal right to.
Again, our guest, Cory Doctorow, his new book, His Little Brother, and our next caller is Bruce. Bruce, join us.
Hi, guys. I had a question about the fulfilled prophecy of this government sort of spying or snooping on people, the whole needle in the haystack argument. Wouldn't any, you know, self-respecting, I don't know if you can say that, terrorist know not to use any of this technology if they really wanted to get away with something? I mean, how good do they think their own technology and communications and all the email systems is that they can outsmart an NSA operation? So I would assume that any real terrorist or anyone who's got some nefarious plan would keep them off the grid rather than put them on the grid and risk being caught. So the whole argument for any of the snooping is moot. It's done. There is no argument for using this technology to snoop on everyone when the bad guys have already years ago, 10 years ago, probably decided, you know, we're not going to risk getting caught. We're just going to stay off the grid on all this.
I don't think the evidence bears that out. I think, you know, Osama bin Laden, for example, apparently was shipping around USB sticks instead of using email. But it's hard to imagine doing anything significant these days with that electronic coordination, just because it's massively more difficult to do it. I think, though, that a more significant fact is that Al-Qaeda are not 100-foot-tall giants with superpowers. They're mostly a collection of deluded religious nuts who are suicidally depressed and prepared to blow themselves up. And mostly they fail at it, with a couple of pretty spectacular exceptions. That in general, they get caught through old-fashioned policing. You know, the NSA talks a big game about how they keep catching terrorists with this enormous surveillance dragnet that they've established, but they can't show any hard evidence of it. And whenever they've proffered evidence of it, a critical examination, even cursory one, shows that mostly what they did was catch them with, you know, informants and all the other things.
Mainly about foreigners, but somehow those Chechens got through that foreigners.
Yeah. And you know what? Speaking as a foreigner, I'm not too sanguine about the idea that spying on foreigners is cool.
Here's a counter view. Ben says, I worry about the NSA as well, but what about the corporations gathering all the same information for the purposes of driving profit? I think that's equally scary, just to put another point of view.
I agree, and I think those two things go hand in hand because there's a surveillance business model for companies. You know, in the UK, we've got data that the mobile phone companies, a major source of their revenue is the government money given to them to spy on their customers. These are interrelated problems. I think that transparency in the surveillance programs and a kind of accountability there undertaken by the state will start to erode some of the surveillance by corporations as well. You know, the passage of the Patriot Act and the limitations that it made on privacy were an invitation to companies like Google and Facebook and so on to try and monetize your individual information. These problems can't be solved individually.
I want to go to some more calls, but let me first go to some emails and web postings. Tiffany writes, I'm a big fan of the book and of your writing. I especially like how you portray female nerd or techie characters. In my experience, a lot of media gets this demographic disturbingly wrong. Is there anything you can share about your process in writing Van as an authentic, believable character? She's one of the cadre I alluded to before. Was she more or less or about the same level of difficulty to write than the more standard male techies? Either way, she's one of my favorite characters in a book filled with really cool characters.
So I wrote Little Brother around the time my wife got pregnant with our daughter, and we knew it was a daughter from pretty early on. And a lot of the thinking I was doing around then was the kind of role models I wanted my own daughter to have in life. And certainly working at Electronic Frontier Foundation and in techie circles, especially free and open source software circles, I've met some amazing women programmers, women geeks, deep expert women engineers that I've been able to refer to on my own mentally and trying to think about how that stuff works.
By the way, I have listeners who don't like the word geek. For males or females.
Well,
do you have any feelings about it?
No, I'm okay with it. It's, you know, language is descriptive, not prescriptive. I don't think anyone hears geek and thinks someone biting the head off a chicken anymore. So I'm okay with it.
Why Van is, she's Korean? And,
yeah.
Yeah, why? Any reason?
Well, people have to be something. you know, there's no reason not to have people represent all the different ethnicities that are present in San Francisco. When you walk around San Francisco, not everyone is Caucasian.
Well, you got a Mexican guy in this group too.
Yeah, and a black character and, you know, characters who are of multiple ethnicities. The story is sometimes about their ethnicity when it matters. You know, there's the Latin American character, has a kind of come to Jesus talk with Marcus about the difference between being a lawbreaker when you're a person of color and the kind of consequences that people of color play for their high-spirited hijinks and being a privileged white guy. And sometimes that arises as a significant part of it. But a lot of the times I try to make that diversity just part of the landscape because there's no reason for people not to be some ethnicity that isn't sort of default Caucasian Anglo. And, you know, I grew up in Toronto, which is a very multicultural city, and San Francisco is a very multicultural city.
Listener writes, I'd read something about this, so maybe you can clarify. Does Corey make all of his books downloadable for free, or did he do that especially for the One City, One Book program?
No, I've done that since my book started coming out. My first novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, was the first book ever published under a Creative Commons license. It allows people to download it and redistribute it non-commercially, culturally, but encourages them to go and buy the commercial editions if they like it.
You're losing money on that, though, do you think?
Well, it's impossible to say authoritatively. You would need an apples-to-apples comparison. You need sort of a time machine where you could re-release the same book and see how the sales have done. I mean, you know, Little Brother sold 100,000 hardcovers. Homeland was the sequel was on the New York Times bestseller list for a month. So, you know, I'm okay with that. But I think a really significant point here is that whether or not you make your books available for free, they're available for free. It takes the same number of clicks to download the book for free as it does to pay for it, no matter what the book is, no matter what policy the author is. So for me, I think the critical question is making sure not that everybody who reads pays, but making sure everybody willing to pay reads, making some kind of social contract with your audience through a public act of generosity and trust in the hopes that they'll reciprocate it. And
it's kind of what public radio is built on. Actually.
It really is. Well, and you know, radio is one of those things where you can't control who listens to it. And so you need to have some model for non-coercive payment in order to make radio work. And sometimes that's advertisement and sometimes it's voluntary payments.
Another listener writes, the problem with writing your own code is your code is compiled and those compilers are compiled with unexplored code that goes back 4 decades. It's work than most think.
Yeah, no, I agree. In fact, I suspect that emailer is referencing a very classic essay called On Trusting Trust, which was published in the, I think, in Usenix Security. And it's an essay about someone who actually put a backdoor in a compiler that would, whenever it was compiling a compiler, put a backdoor in that. We're getting deep into the nerdy weeds here. But it's true that it's hard to trust all the hardware and the software back down to the very basic code and the linker and the compiler and the text editor and the metal that you're running on. Nevertheless, there is a basis for building up that trust. One of the ways that we can do that is by having compilers that you can look into, you know, compilers that are open instead of compilers that are closed. And most code that we're using is compiled on open compilers like GCC.
Are you constantly keeping up with new technology? I mean, for some people I know, it's almost a full-time job in itself, and you seem, you know, obviously very conversant with it.
Well, I try to be what Kevin Kelly calls a technology gourmet. So I know what I want technology to do for my life, and I seek out technologies that make my life like that. But I don't use technologies just because they're new. I don't have a Facebook account. I think Facebook is a Skinner box designed to make you undervalue your privacy. And so, you know, Facebook doesn't make my life better, so I don't use it. And, you know, for the record, I think no one else should, too. But, you know, if that's what floats your boat, by all means. But I think that having a thing that you want out of technology and then seeking other technologies that do it for you is a great way to approach this stuff.
Here's a Facebook comment. Ken asks, why did Krasny give a statement from DNI James R. Clapper when the first caller mentioned NSA? Have the feds contacted KQED in order to censor or mold the discussion about NSA illegal spying? Let me just clarify that, Ken. We just wanted to get Corey's response to the agency's perspective, and we were not contacted. A couple of good questions by a tweet from Pete. Tweet from Pete. How would your guest suggest the USA best defend itself from cyber attack without back doors? And also, is Glenn Greenwald really a journalist?
How would the U.S. defend itself without back doors? I think a better question is, how can the U.S. defend itself if all of its critical infrastructure is filled with back doors?
Maybe I want to explain what a back door is.
A back door is imagine that you have an important. In fact, let's use a real world example. Last week, Miss Teen USA called the FBI because someone had figured out how to compromise her computer and was taking naked pictures of her through the camera in her computer and was trying to extort her into performing live sex acts on her camera, or those pictures would have been released to her social media accounts because the person who'd taken over her camera also took over her keyboard.
There's a moment in your novel where a young girl says, look, I've got a picture of you. I'll send it out to the superintendent because he's being a truant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's she's using her own camera
right.
to take the picture. Your world is filled
with
sensors
stuff,
that you're supposed to trust that if they are not built correctly, then people might be lurking inside of them watching you. And this happened to Miss Teen USA last week. If systems are not designed to only allow the people who are supposed to access them to access them, if they have lurking in them some kind of code that you can use to access them, even if you don't have the password, that password will eventually leak out. That back door, the magic incantation to get in, will eventually leak out, and people will be inside of your devices compromising your security. This is a recurring theme. You know, locksmiths for years knew that there was a way to open most locks called lock bumping, where you would put a blank key in and then rap it with a hammer, and it would cause all the pins to shoot up, and you could turn the handle and open it. And so did burglars. The only people who didn't know about it were the suckers buying the locks, right? That's the worst possible world to be in, to think that you're secure and not be secure. Bruce Schneier uses the example of having a car with bad brakes. If you have a car with bad brakes and you know it, you drive slowly and carefully. The worst situation is to have a car with bad brakes and not know it and put your foot down, because that's when you die. If you think that you're secure, if you think your systems are well made and are designed only to let the people who are supposed to access them, and in fact they're designed so that anyone who knows a secret that the NSA has inserted into them can access them, then you are living in a fool's paradise, and we can't be secure. And of course, Glenn Greenwald is a journalist. He writes for The Guardian. How can that not make him a journalist?
Here's David, our next caller. David, you're on Forum. Hi.
Hi. First off, thanks for turning me on to Noise Bridge, a few blocks from the KQED offices in your book. And secondly, in Homeland, not once is Tor2Web mentioned at all, and I'm like tearing my hair out at the end of the book that Tor Hidden Services play a central part of the book, and this service isn't mentioned.
Sorry, which service? Tor?
Tor2Web.
Oh, Tor2Web. You're right. So let me unpack that just briefly. There's a wonderful maker hackerspace in the Mission called NoiseBridge that anyone can join. It's a kind of cooperative space where you can go and use 3D printers and a metal shop and a machine shop and so on. One of the things that Homeland, the sequel to Little Brother, makes a lot of use of is this system called Tor, the Onion Router, that the Office of Naval Intelligence developed to allow people to send secret, uncensorable messages.
I think we've had the founder of NoiseBridge on Forum, Mitch Altman.
Yeah. And the Tor service is a way to, in an uncensorable, unsurveillable way, communicate around the internet, to pull web pages back to your browser, and also to run hidden services that you can only access through Tor. Tor2Web is a utility that makes this much, much simpler. And you're right. I didn't get into it in the book. It is an important service if you're looking for a good keyword to stick into your search engine to figure out how to make your information more secure, your information consumption more secure. Type Tor2Web into your search engine and find out more about it.
Thank you for the call. Here's Riley who writes, I keep hearing this crypto conversation and it baffles me. Why should I care if the government is reading my emails? If they want to read about what I'm doing next Tuesday, fine. I don't feel it affects me at all. Could you explain why I should care?
Sure. And that's a question that comes up a lot. And I think that there's at least three important reasons to care about your privacy. The first is what you might call the tuttle-buttle problem, right? If you've seen Brazil, the Terry Gilliam movie, there's a character named Henry Buttle who is mistaken for another person called Henry Tuttle and ends up in all kinds of hot water as a result of it. And, you know, we have our own version of that. We call it the no-fly list, which is full of thousands of names of people whose data has been gathered and assumption has been made about them based on their data. And that assumption isn't one that they're allowed to challenge in court. It's not one that they're allowed to see the basis for. It's not one that they're even allowed to know about. But as a consequence of it, they can't fly, or every time they do fly, they're confronted with this horrific kind of rigmarole. And, you know, the people on the no-fly list include small babies and at one point Senator Ted Kennedy. It is a bad thing to have this unaccountable system of inference drawing from lots of data that's snaffled up from you in order to limit your freedom. But there's another problem, which is the Cardinal Richelieu problem. Cardinal Richelieu famously said, if you give me six lines in an honest man's hand, I will find in them a reason to hang him. So if someone decides that they don't like you and they have access to all of your personal information, they can find in it something that you can't explain that looks a bit dodgy. And then the last thing is that even though you and I might be lucky enough to enjoy a life whose skeletons are all closet free, we know people whose skeletons aren't. We know people who are survivors of abuse, people who are HIV positive, people who haven't come out of the closet, people who haven't told their families that they've abandoned their faith, people who have some reason or another, a legitimate reason, not to want their private information disclosed. And it's our duty, as those of us who are lucky enough not to have skeletons in our closet, to protect our friends, neighbors, and family members who do.
Good reason response. Quick response. We got seconds left. Listener named Ken wants to know if the Department of Homeland Security being moved, Janet Napolitano, former head to California universities, is an example of the feds implementing the fictional police state of Orwell and Doctorow. Oi. Maybe a yes or a no?
I don't think so. I think it's just, you know, cronyism.
Cory Doctorow, good
Thank
to have you.
You
with us. Congratulations again on being selected for the One City, One Book selection for 2013. And again, here we'll be at the San Francisco Main Library, 6 o'clock tonight. We'll be with you if all goes according to plan tomorrow. Thank you for being a part of this morning's forum and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.